Views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus here on beautiful Urbana on WILL AM 580. Today, my guest is Sut Jolly. Sut Jolly is a professor of communication at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and the founder and executive director of the Media Education Foundation, or also known as MEF. MEF started with the aim to make academic research accessible to the popular culture and non-specialist realm. Over the past 10 years, Sut Jolly has been the executive producer of more than 20 videos produced and distributed by the MEF. He's nationally known among many college students for his videotape Dream Worlds, Desire, Sex, Power, and Music video, in which he created and presented his critique of representations of women in popular culture and commercial images. The video received national press after MTV threatened it with a lawsuit. As an author, Sut Jolly's written work includes The Codes of Advertising and a number of other books. He's written broadly on issues of popular representation and I think is safely regarded as one of the world's leading cultural studies scholars in the area of advertising, media, and consumption. It is my great honor to welcome Sut Jolly to Media Matters.
Yes, hello, Bob. It was a pleasure to be on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. And Sut, as you may recall, you were on my show, and our listeners, some of our more faithful listeners will recall, Sut was on our show almost 2 years ago, if not just about 2 years ago. One of the first guests when we went on the air, we had you on, and at that time you were discussing a film that you were just working on with regard to Israel and Palestine. And I think it was the one show that's gotten the most hostile calls in the history of Media Matters. And we've gotten our share of hostile calls. So, because your position then in the movie was that the Palestinians had gotten a raw deal in press coverage in the United States, and that did not seem to sit well with some of our listeners.
No, I mean, it's the one issue even among progressives where people have a lot of progressive people have a blind spot. The film actually has just recently been finished. It's called Peace, Propaganda, and the Promised Land.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to do with U.S. media coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And one of the things, and I'm sure we're going to talk more about this, is we're actually trying to get the latest videos that we've been doing, the latest films we've been doing, we're trying to get it out to actually ordinary people, to individuals.
Yeah, explain that, because, I mean, I don't think many people would understand how the video or the documentary market works, educational video market works. Most of the tapes you've made at Media Education Foundation over the last 10 years or so are not priced to sell to a popular audience. They're not meant to be purchased at the local video store.
No, they're not. I mean, they're priced to be sold to institutions, to universities and colleges who get the video and then place it in their central collection so that it can be used over and over again, you know, over many semesters and in many different classes. And that's just essentially how the Media Education Foundation started off. We never got grants from foundations. And so we essentially started off as a business, making videos and selling them and trying to survive in that way. And the educational market is one of the major places that we were able to tap into. And that has meant, as you said, over the years, we've got a lot of people, millions and millions of people have seen our tapes in classrooms, across the country. But it has meant that because of the way they were priced, that individuals couldn't buy them and show them at home, to families and friends and other people and other places like that.
And now you're changing that approach?
Well, we're not changing. We're trying to add to it, and especially with a couple of our recent films. The Israeli-Palestinian one was one of the first ones, Peace, Propaganda, and the Promised Land. And the way we're now trying to distribute it is actually through the web, and people actually can buy it at an individual price, which is around $29.
I don't think we're allowed to name prices on the
air. So,
just pretend you didn't hear that, listeners. But if you are interested, the website for people to learn more about MEF and just sort of see what you're offering, even if they're not in the market to purchase them, what is the web address?
The web address for our new website, actually, is www.mef.tv.
Oh, boy. How do you get that swanky web address?
We got the address a couple of years ago when we thought we might be expanding in this direction, and it was available, and we now have finally found a use for it. And so that's a website where we're hoping to make things available to individuals and to activists.
Okay, and people can learn about the Media Education Foundation there as well.
Yes, they can. Yeah.
MEF.tv. Well, that's really easy to to lob onto. Now, before we go into the new video you have out that I just had the privilege of watching, Hijacking Catastrophe, I want to talk about this a little more of the history of MEF and your background to give a sense of context for the new film. You are a noted scholar, communication scholar. You know, I'm a communication scholar, too. We're in the same field. We're both professors. We both write books and articles and do research and that sort of thing. But you have really, your career has gone in a different direction from most of our peers. Explain what happened. Why are you now doing what you're doing and not writing articles for journals?
Well, it all started, actually started about 13 years ago when, you know, I was teaching a large lecture class at the University of Massachusetts, you know, where I still am, to do with intro to media and culture. And while I was teaching that, I was trying to teach about images of women on television and especially images of women on MTV, because that's where the culture was and still is. And if I thought if you can get people to think, you know, in some kind of critical distanced way about what is at the, you know, a part of popular culture that really matters to them, that's a way of really, you know, having knowledge matter to them. They can actually use the knowledge, the things they learn in their daily lives. And so I started teaching about images of women on MTV. And as I did that, I started to, you know, bring things into the classroom, examples from videos. And over a period of time, I developed a standalone video, which dealt with images of women on MTV and its connection to, especially to sexual violence and to attitudes that really, really legitimize sexual violence. And when I finished that, I thought, well, if it's kind of useful to me, you know, perhaps it's going to be useful to other teachers. And I put out a very small mailing through the university to other other scholars, to other women's studies departments, to other communication scholars, to see if it might be useful to them. You know, and it was, you know, about 50 people bought it for use in their classrooms. And it most probably would have remained at that if it wasn't for the fact that MTV got wind of it and threatened to sue me over it for using what they claimed were their copyrighted images in my critique. And my position on this was that, in fact, I was absolutely entitled to use those images, even though they were copyrighted by them or by the people who made them, because in the Copyright Act, there is a provision that allows what's called fair use. And I thought this fit perfectly into fair use, that if for me to talk about images of women on MTV, I had to show those images as I was critiquing them. And when MTV threatened to sue me, actually, it led to a lot of publicity at the university, led a lot of publicity in the media, and also led me to realize that, in fact, there was a big market out there for videos, not books, but videos and films that dealt with this kind of stuff. And videos and films are, I mean, unfortunately, people don't read in the way they used to. And if you really want to reach a non-specialist market, even if you want to reach the students in my classes, if you want to reach the kid in the back row, we've really got to think about where the language has moved on to. And video and film is the language of the modern age. And so since that time, I've really been focusing in on, as you said in your introduction, trying to take the best cutting-edge academic research and my own work, and rather than thinking straight away, putting it into writing form, thinking about putting it into a form where you don't have to be a PhD to understand it.
And as the MTV example, I think, demonstrates, a lot of the videos that Media Education Foundation has done, and a lot of the work it's best known for, has dealt with gender roles, representations of sexuality. I think, you know, is that a fair assessment, would you say, Seb?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, especially our early work, you know, I did Dreamworlds, and then the two films that I think we're most well known for, one is with Gene Kilbourne, it's called Killing Us Softly 3, advertising's image of women, which dealt with images of women in advertising, and then also Tough Guys, and the guys is spelled G-U-I-S-E. Which dealt with images of men and masculinity in the media, and those have really actually been the videos that we're really being identified with. At the same time, we've done other videos on commercialization. We've done videos with you and you know with other scholars of media conglomeration, and so we also look at issues of ownership and commercialization and broader issues. But certainly, it's been pushed by the gender stuff.
And last year, you did a video. Last year you did a video I had the privilege of watching set on wrestling. And tell a little bit about that video. What drove you to do a video on professional wrestling, and what was the argument you were making? What was the response to the video?
In professional wrestling, whenever you say professional wrestling, one of the things that happens is people always start smiling and laughing. And partly it's because everyone regards professional wrestling as, you know, idiotic and childish. And so immediately you get this kind of notion, well, how can you take anything so idiotic and so childish and so outlandish so seriously? And the answer I always give people is the reason you should take professional wrestling seriously is because of its popularity, is because of the millions and millions of people that watch it every week and the millions and millions of boys and young boys who watch it every week. That something that popular deserves to be looked at in its own right. And partly it's also because I kind of grew up on wrestling, and I was always fascinated by it.
Oh, you never told me that part before. How the truth finally comes out.
Well, you see, I think if you're going to be an analyst of popular culture, if you're going to critique it, at some level, you've got to be a little bit of a fan. Because if you don't understand why it's popular, then you can't understand how it really works. And so, at some level, you've got to be. You know, you can't be just a fan. But at some level, you've got to understand why it would, you know, why people would watch it, why it would be exciting to them, you know, why it's pleasurable to them. And you know, when I was growing up, I was always fascinated by wrestling. I don't think I was always, you know, caught up in it. I always thought, okay, why is this popular? And the reason we did a film on it was partly because no one else has looked at this, and partly because it's one of the places where I think masculinity is really being defined and is really being constructed. In the modern age.
And as that film points out, and it relates to your notions of masculinity, I mean, professional wrestling, for a lot of our listeners, it might be over the age of, say, 20 or 25 or 30, who maybe once watched professional wrestling 20 years ago or skimmed by it on the cable network sometime, but watched it for maybe like a minute, might not be aware of what has the transformation it has undergone in the past 5 or 10 years as it's become a much larger, more sophisticated industry.
No, absolutely. This is not the wrestling from the 1980s. This is not the wrestling of, you know, the old days of Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior, etc. And even the Macho Man. Even though some of these wrestlers are still around, the wrestling we're talking about really kind of transformed in the early 1990s. As a result of, I think the real genius of Vince McMahon in recognizing what was going on in his market. And it became much more spectacle-oriented. It became much more violent. It became much more oriented around some really kind of outlandish attitudes and acts that these wrestlers were performing.
And a lot of it deals with gender. I mean, talk a little bit about the gender roles or codes that are built into the pro wrestling spectacle today.
Well, if you look at wrestling and say, well, you know, in wrestling, what is a real man? I mean, how is masculinity defined? You know, and one of the things we know is there's nothing natural about masculinity and femininity. You know, we learn how to be men that are recognized as normal men. We learn how to be women who are recognized as normal females. And so you have to look at what the messages and the culture are about, you know, what does it mean to be normal? And if you look at wrestling and if you watch a lot of wrestling, the message that you'll get, the notion you'll get of what a real man is someone who scares people. A real man is someone who intimidates people. A real man never backs down. A real man is strong. A real man, in the end, can always rely upon violence to be able to control other people. And in the end, in fact, if I had to come up with kind of one image of what a real man is on wrestling, it's in fact is a bully, someone who controls other people through fear and intimidation, controls someone weaker through fear and intimidation. And if that's the image, if that's the kind of definition of masculinity that is being portrayed in wrestling, and I think it undoubtedly is, and the question is, what does it mean that we're having a whole generation of boys, you know, the huge number of boys who watch this, who regard the bully, who regard being a bully, in fact, as the way to be a man. And I think the question we have to ask is, what is that going to do? What's that going to do in terms of the relationships of boys with other boys, of men with other men, of men with women, of men with girls? What does it do when that is defined through control and through intimidation?
What sort of role do women play in wrestling?
Again, it's really changed dramatically over the last 10 years. In the 1970s and 1980s, you know, there was the occasional female character around. But the women were not centrally, you know, were not central to the narratives. And you have to remember, wrestling actually very little of what is important about wrestling happens in the ring. Most of what's interesting in wrestling and wrestling shows happens outside the ring, happens in the storylines, happens in the narratives, happens in the way the characters are constructed. And one of the things that happens in the 1990s is the women become much more integrated into the storylines, and there are major characters who are not just wrestlers. I mean, there are some wrestlers, but in fact, most of the major female characters in wrestling are there just for their looks, are there just because of their bodies. I mean, you know, they're very, very stereotypical in how they look. I mean, they could be straight out of the pages of Penthouse and Playboy. I mean, they've come from pornography, but they are there in the narratives that, you know, young boys are watching every, you know, sometimes two or three times a week. And these women, I mean, they're defined only through their sexuality. They're defined only through their bodies. They're only defined in relationship to men. There is a great deal of violence, of sexual violence, that's committed against these women in a way that makes it pleasurable and makes it fun. And again, so if you're a young boy and you're trying to figure out how to be a man and how you relate to women, the messages and the stories that professional wrestling encourages you to take on are very, very dangerous, both to young boys and to girls. And I think we're starting to see the evidence of this in dating violence that's going into younger and younger audiences. Again, I don't think it's just wrestling. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think wrestling by itself. One of the reasons to look at wrestling is it is the most kind of spectacular part of what is going on in the popular culture. So it's not just wrestling. It's also what's going on in music videos. It's also what's going on in sports. It's also what's going on in movies. It's going on everywhere else in the culture. But wrestling kind of brings it, you know, encapsulates it. And that's why it's important to look at it, I think. Not because of wrestling by itself, but because of what it tells us about what's going on in the rest of the popular culture.
Now, at the same time that this is going on in wrestling and some of the other aspects of popular culture, these sort of images and representations of women and masculinity and sexuality, we see a lot of programs coming along like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, programming which is much more open to lesbianism and gay sexuality in a way that really would have been unthinkable 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you reconcile these phenomena, or do you?
No, I think that, in one sense, I think the two things are connected. I mean, the reason we have more varied images of gay, bisexual, transgender people now in the media is because of the activism of those populations. You know, is gay and lesbian activists and bisexual activists who said, you know, we're fed up with the limited way in which we're represented, and they fought very effectively to change the level of the nature of representation. And so, you know, if you'd have told me, you know, 10 years ago, you know, that essentially they would be, you know, a gay character on, you know, most sitcoms or on most shows on television, you know, I would have laughed at you. But now we've come a long way in that time. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time that's happened, I mean, remember, when you have a culture when you have a masculine culture that is based on, you know, ultra masculinity, and that's based on, in one sense, and a great deal based on homophobia, on defining masculinity in opposition to gayness, then these new representations, in fact, are going to lead to a kind of backlash. And I think that's part of what's happening in wrestling, is that there is a backlash to the challenge of what a real man is, and the backlash is back to a much more traditional mode, almost back to the 1950s. And so I think there's a direct connection between the kind of almost stereotypical 1950s one-dimensional view we get of masculinity in places like, I mean, I think in places like music videos, in wrestling, and the challenges that have come to traditional masculinity in the last 20 years or so.
If, in fact, the opening up for gay and lesbian imagery is a reflection of the strength and success of gay and lesbian political organizing and mobilization, could one then say that the persistence and continued development of these sort of masculinist interpretations of, you know, these heavy sort of violent-driven, super-masculine notions of male sexuality and masculinity, to some extent be a reflection of the weakness of feminism as a social movement?
And I think it's partly to do with the success of feminism as a social movement.
Oh.
Again, I think it's partly, I mean, I think the gay and lesbian movement is connected to the feminist movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that those are connected. I think the feminist movement is one of the most powerful and most successful movements in history,
mm-hmm.
in terms of being able to change our attitudes around gender in a very short period of time. And I think, you know, young boys and young girls these days are living lives that they could never have even thought about living, because of what their parents did, and because of their parents and their, you know, changing the environment within which they can think about how to be men and women. At the same time that's happened, that has also been an incredible challenge to traditional masculinity. So I think the more you see these very stereotypical representations of masculinity, as I said, that could be, I mean, that they are from the 1950s. The more you see them, the more I think you are recognizing in them. I mean, this is kind of a scared response. this is a response of people who are having nightmares and anxieties about traditional notions being challenged, and so they've retreated into these traditional images in a way to protect themselves from the incredible turmoil that's going on in the rest of the culture. So I think you have to see both of those things together. It's not just stereotypes work on their own. Stereotypes always work within a specific context, and sometimes are in response to a specific challenge that has been made.
We're talking to Sut Jolly today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Sut Jolly is a professor of communication at the University of Massachusetts, and he's the founder and executive director of the Media Education Foundation, or MEF. MEF has made scores of excellent educational videos and documentaries on media and popular culture. And we've been talking about some of them that deal with issues of masculinity and sexuality and representation of gender for the last few minutes. In addition, Sut Jolly's group, Media Education Foundation, has just completed a brand new film. I think it's by far the most popular film that's been made in MES history. It's really sort of a new page in many respects, called Hijacking Catastrophe. And I want to talk about that now. But before we turn to that, let me remind listeners that we're recording this program slightly before going on air. So do not try to call in today. This is not a show with a chance for call. And let Sut Jolly and myself, Bob McChesney, do the yakking today. Hijacking Catastrophe, Sut, your brand new, is this a film or a video? I mean,
it's a video and DVD.
It's a video and DVD.
Yeah.
It's really a departure, or it's part of the crystallizes a process of departure from the initial model for MEF. Talk a little bit about your thinking behind it.
Yeah, well, I think the next few months are going to be absolutely critical in the history of the United States. I think the next election, the next presidential election that's going to come up, is going to really define the future for a whole generation. If George Bush is elected again, many of the changes that presently are temporary will become permanent. And so I think the next presidential election is a watershed mark in American political history. And I think as we come up to that, I think Americans need now more than ever, they need new kinds of information, and they need new kinds of educational information so that they're able to make that decision in a rational way. And so we produced Hijacking Catastrophe as an educational tool to help American citizens to be able to really figure out what's going on and what's really at stake in this coming election.
Well, and I think by the way you framed it, it's pretty clear you have a position in the coming election, a position on the caliber of the people in power currently in the White House and in Washington. What is the point? What is the basic theme of Hijacking Catastrophe?
Well, we're really focusing in on the Iraq War, and we're really focusing in on how the subtitle to the film. So that the whole title is Hijacking Catastrophe, and the subtitle is 9/11, Fear and the Selling of American Empire. And so the film really looks at how the trauma of 9/11 was used in very, very cynical ways by the Bush administration to push through a radical agenda, especially for foreign policy, that they had in the back of their minds for 10 years. And to push that agenda through at a time when Americans were grieving and were angry, in a way that Americans wouldn't think seriously and wouldn't think carefully about what was going on. And I think the Iraq War and the nightmare that the Iraq War has turned into is a result of that. That Americans got into this war without really knowing what was really at stake. They were lied to by the Bush administration, who said that the Iraq War was connected to weapons of mass destruction. We know that Saddam Hussein doesn't have weapons of mass destruction. That it was connected somehow. That Saddam Hussein was somehow connected to the attacks on 9/11. We know they had nothing. We know that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with those attacks. But in their grief, Americans went along with this disastrous policy of trying to construct a different kind of American empire that was really going to be based on a different definition of how violence would be used by America.
Now, in the film, Sut, I mean, before you even get to 9/11 and the attack on the World Trade Center, and there is some very striking footage of that for those when you see the film, you really go through
a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for the entire WILL severe weather coverage area until 6 o'clock this evening.
Role in the world and the proper role of the military in the world today. Tell me a little about that. I mean, who are these neoconservatives? How central are they to what's going on today?
Yeah, again, I think there's been a lot of talk about the neoconservatives without a huge amount of kind of detail about who they are and what they believe in. So what the film does is it kind of traces back the intellectual roots of our present foreign policy. And when we talk about the neoconservatives, we're essentially looking at three major people. We're talking about Dick Cheney, who is now, you know, vice president. And the real intellectual kind of leader of the neoconservatives is Paul Wolfowitz. And then Donald Rumsfeld is also connected to this. I mean, you could also talk about them as hardliners. You could also talk about them as hawks. And these people have been around for a long time. And what they're really seeing right now is the culmination of their dreams of what America should be doing after the Cold War, after the Soviet Union collapsed, when America was left as the only superpower. They really had a vision that, okay, without any opposition, America actually can take over the world. It can rule the world militarily. It doesn't have to be bound by international organizations, you know, those pesky things like the United Nations. It doesn't have to be bound by international treaties, that it can do whatever it wants. It can define whatever enemies it wants based on its own assessment of risk, that it can attack whoever it wants without giving any legitimation for it whatsoever. That was the vision they had immediately after the Soviet Union collapsed. Was this update? They saw this as an opportunity to build, you know, a new Rome. I mean, that's the image they have in their mind, is this notion of the Roman Empire. And they really one of the think tanks they set up was called, in fact, the Project for a New American Century. And that's how they regard that's the vision they had, that in fact the 21st century would be a century in which America would rule without opposition and would rule through military might. Now, when this was first presented, and it was first written in 1992 at the tail end of the first Bush administration, mm-hmm. by Paul Wolfowitz in a draft of the National Security Strategy, people thought he was nuts. I mean, people within the Republican Party thought he was nuts. Democrats like Joseph Biden were essentially speechless when they saw this vision of how they wanted America to operate in the world. And in fact, at that time, it was seen as too controversial, and they had to downplay it a little bit. Well, in the Clinton years, during the Clinton presidency, these guys didn't go away. I mean, what happened was they went into think tanks, and I said one of these think tanks was called the Project for a New American Century, and I really urge listeners to go to the website, punch in Project for a New American Century into Google, and they have a website, and you can go there, and all their documents actually are online, and you can see firsthand exactly how they're thinking.
So, yeah, this isn't like some left-wing interpretation. This is the original documents there. You can just read them yourself.
This is the original documents from them, but even they realized, even they thought that what they were doing was too radical. I mean, mm-hmm. what they wanted was a really expanded military budget. They wanted to expand the military budget by about $100 billion a year. Yeah, that's an incredible number. And even they realized when they were talking about this, even they realized that what they were proposing was so radical that it would be really difficult to convince Americans. In fact, it would be difficult even to convince, the moderates within their own party to go along with this.
What confuses me as you describe this is understanding what motivates this, what moves this. It's not like the United States was a weakling in the world prior to 1992 or 2000 for that matter. It was by far the dominant military power, the dominant economic power in the world. What is the motivation for significantly ratcheting up U.S. military power in the world?
Yeah. I mean, one is just to get more economic control, which has always been the function of the American empire. What's different with the neoconservatives is that along with that comes a kind of ideological belief that what they're doing is not only good for American profits and for their friends, but it's also the right thing to do, that it is morally the right thing to do. And they're driven by almost a religious belief that what they're doing is not just about the old way of dealing with power and money, but this is actually about ideology. And that's what's really worrying. That's what's really frightening about them. I mean, they are fundamentalists. Some of them are religious fundamentalists, but they're also fundamentalists in terms of they really believe this thing. They really believe that they have the right and they have the duty to, in fact, rule the world according to their own ideas. That's what really makes them frightening.
In popular parlance, Secretary of State Colin Powell is often held up as being sort of the non-neoconservative in the think tank or the brain trust of the administration.
Yeah.
Who sort of stands for the old school style of working with the UN and actually multilateral approaches to international problems. Does that square with your research?
Well, that's sometimes way he's presented, and I think he may be retreating to that now. I mean, I think he lost all credibility with anyone when he went in front of the United Nations before the Iraq War, you know, and lied about Saddam Hussein's potential to have weapons of mass destruction. And that was the point at which, you know, you could see Colin Powell's kind of true colors coming out. But that is the way he's presented. And in one sense, if you wanted to think about it, I mean, I think this is really the difference between George Bush and John Kerry. You know, is that, I'm no fan of Kerry that says, you know, Kerry is somehow really different and believes in it, you know, has a different set of values and really has a different set of interests at stake. I mean, remember, both Republicans and Democrats are part of the same business class. I mean, as Gore Vidal once said, I think this is the best line, he said, America has one political party with two right wings. And so we have a business party, but, you know, that business party has factions. And what we're seeing right now is a division within that business party, within the elite, of different ways to hold on to American power. John Kerry, I think, represents, you know, the old way of doing it, which is the reason we need to have multilateral organizations like United Nations is because that's good for America. And, you know, we need to, instead of invading Iraq, what we need to do is we need to buy off butchers and dictators like Saddam Hussein, which is what the United States did, you know, for a decade before the first Gulf War. But that's a more rational way to, you know, you don't really care about democracy and human rights, which, you know, no American administration has cared about those things. You can just buy off people and you let other people do your dirty work. The neoconservatives have a different version of that. I mean, they think that is, they want to transform that. They say that's an inefficient way of doing it. If you're going to really control those areas, you need to go in with full American power and full American force and really change things. You don't need to work with people. You really need to transform things on the ground. And so we really have a difference of strategy, not a difference of ends, a difference of strategy. However, I think it really does make a difference at this point. There is a difference as to what will be what will happen after the next election if George Bush is elected again. That way of America being in the world, you know, unilateral, preemptive war based on military power, that will become permanent.
We're talking to Sut Jolly today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Sut Jolly is a professor of communication at the University of Massachusetts, as well as the founder and executive director of the Media Education Foundation, MEF. Is a producer of numerous documentaries for classroom use videos. And under Sut Jolly's direction, they have produced a brand new video, Hijacking Catastrophe. And what's the second half of the title, Sut?
9/11. Fear and the Selling of American Empire.
9/11, Fear and the Selling of American Empire, just released this summer. I've had the privilege of watching the rough cut this morning. It's 65 minutes long, at least the version I saw. And it's a very powerful and impressive piece of work. And I urge you, listeners, if you're interested in finding out more about this, go to www.mef.tv. And you can learn more about this video as well as the other work that Media Education Foundation has done. And one of the words in the subtitle that's very important and a theme that comes through in the documentary is the term fear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the striking themes you develop, the importance of fear-mongering in the population to push these policies through. And at one point, one of your guests, I think it was Norman Solomon, made the comparison to FDR. And how FDR said the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, and how today the motto seems to be the only thing we have to fear is not fearing enough.
Right.
But why is fear so important in this documentary and in your analysis of what's going on?
When you operate through fear, you know, when you're scared, there's a pain in the pit of your stomach, you know, your hands are sweating, and you're not thinking straight. And when you're scared, you can be exploited in all kinds of ways. And it's a very, very bad time to make decisions is in a state of fear or even in a state of grief. I mean, any grief counselor will tell you do not make any decisions when you're going through something that is really traumatic. So when you have a population that's afraid, they will not be thinking straight. And you can manipulate people through fear in ways that you can't manipulate people if you have to talk about ideas. I think if you present it to the American people, look, do you want this version of the American Empire, which means that, you know, that your kids are going to be, that there has to be a draft, that many more of your kids are going to be in the armed forces, that they're going to come back dead, that you have to kill large numbers of foreign people. You know, most Americans would say, yeah, that's crazy. We're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. That's not a way to be in the world. And so the discussion doesn't take place along those. You have to push that policy you have to push that real policy through this notion that, in fact, the world is a really dangerous place, and this is the only thing we can do to protect ourselves. And to do that, you've got to make people afraid. Now, there are reasons to be afraid, and I think the reason, I mean, fear is in the subtitle of our film, but also 9/11. And that's why 9/11 is so fundamental to how they were able to put into place what they've done.
And if I can just interject here, because, I mean, I think the way that the Bush administration and the neoconservatives present 9/11 is that this is sort of the catalyzing event that triggered this war on terror and called for this whole new world order, new regime. But that's really not the way you contextualize it in the film.
Well, it may be a catalyst. It's not a causal thing.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in this document that appears on the website of the Project for a New American Century, one of the things these neoconservatives say, and this was a document written in September of 2000. This is a full year before 9/11, and in it they actually say, you know, we realize what we're proposing is really radical, and it's going to take a long time to convince Americans that, you know, they should go along with this. And then they say, and it's these chilling words, they say, it's going to be really difficult absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. And that is what they said in September of 2000. That is, unless people are scared out of their minds by some kind of attack on America, we're not going to be able to do this. But if we get this attack, if we get our new Pearl Harbor, then we will be able to push this through very easily.
Well, you hear that, Sutton. You're saying, well, maybe these conspiracy theorists about 9/11, you know, have got something. It might not be a smoking gun, but it certainly is. It's warming up the room.
I mean, when it comes to the conspiracy theorists and, you know, and the conspiracy stories around this, I think we have to be very careful. For a long time, I resisted, you know, even thinking about these issues. And I've actually changed my mind a little bit. There's a great new book out. I don't know if your listeners are aware of it. It's by a person called David Ray Griffin, and it's called The New Pearl Harbor. And what he does is he collects together a lot of the information from, you know, all these, the books that have been written about, you know, how much did the Bush administration know, did they plan it, etc. And he gathers them all together and sort of presents, like, here's the evidence. And I think if you are a thinking person and you look at all this evidence, the very least that you would be thinking, this is my position on this, is that there are a whole series of unanswered questions that have to be answered before we really figure out what happened on September the 11th. And the commission that's going on right now is not looking at those basic questions. And before we get to, you know, what actually did happen, was it planned beforehand? I think we don't know enough right now. What we need to have before that is, in fact, a real investigation, an independent investigation about these unanswered questions. And I think if we did that, then we'd have some more basis on which to figure out, what did they know, when did they know it, et cetera.
You know, offhand, can you just mention one or two of the sort of questions that ought to be answered that we don't know the answer to?
Yeah, sure. The first thing he asks is, you know, why were the planes allowed to crash into the World Trade Center and to the Pentagon when standard operating procedures means that any time a plane goes off radar, off course from radar, that fighter jets are scrambled and you can shoot down any plane within the continental United States within 10 minutes. On the morning of September the 11th, standard operating procedures were not followed that essentially allowed those planes to crash into the World Trade Centers and into the Pentagon. Why? How did that happen? You know, the Pentagon, one of the most heavily guarded buildings in the world. I mean, in fact, you know, it has fighter planes very, very close to it, and it also has its own defense system. How was this allowed to happen? That one of the most heavily defended buildings in the history of the world, you know, could be attacked in this way. So there's some basic questions. People are also asking questions about the collapse of the buildings. How could the buildings have collapsed? With the planes hitting them, as they did, and this is partly kind of physics. You know, many people have claimed that the buildings could not have collapsed based on the amount of heat that was generated through the explosions. So there's some very basic questions, and again, I don't pretend to know the answers to them, and I don't think anyone actually does, because I think to do that, you need to have a real independent investigation. But the reason I'm always hesitant to mention this, because I think there is a tendency to get tied up in these conspiracy theories,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's dangerous, because I think on the one hand, we can ask, you know, why did this happen? But for me, you know, and that in one sense, that is conjecture right now. But one of the things that is not conjecture is that when 9/11 happened, it was used in a very particular way. And I think what we need to focus on is how was it used? What was pushed through in the grief and anger that Americans were facing at that time or were feeling at that time? And so my tendency on this is always to read this politically.
Yeah.
It's not what might have happened, it's actually what did happen. And how do we understand that? And how do you understand the present, not in terms of conjecture, but in terms of analyzing the world in the way it actually is, and then how do we act in the world based on that knowledge?
Just recently we had on our program as a guest Chalmers Johnson, the author of the new book, The Sorrows of Empire, who's also one of the many experts that is on hijacking catastrophe on camera, on screen. And in his book, he argues that there are four basic problems with the sort of this emerging neoconservative empire that's being built. And you talk about all of them in your film, which is, I don't know if that was coincidental or you relied upon his book, but at any rate, one of them that I think is really important, Chalmers Johnson argues whenever you have an empire, a serious empire, what it leads to invariably is a campaign of blatant lying by governments and propaganda to the population, that they go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And that one of the themes clearly of hijacking catastrophe is the amount of disinformation and misinformation that's being spread by the government and the truly woeful job our news media are doing of counteracting it.
But Chalmers Johnson was a very important part of our video. And he actually he's the first expert that we have on. He kind of opens the whole thing, and we relied, a great deal upon both on his previous book, Blowback,
mm-hmm.
and on the new book, Sorrows of Empire, both of which I think are required reading for anyone who wants to really understand what's going on. And as you said, he says empires have various characteristics. One of them is militarism, that yet the whole society gets built around going to war. And when you do that, you're going to find wars to go to.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, we've already had two major wars in the 21st century. In a very short period of time. That's not an accident. That's the way the society is set up. And he also, as you say, talks about secrecy, that part of an empire is secrecy and lying and deception. And I think in that sense, what has happened since 9/11 is a classic case in how a ruling elite class can use fear and anger to lie. And to deceive the population into going along with a war that isn't about any of the real reasons that are given. And in that sense, the media have absolutely failed their democratic function. They absolutely failed to ask the very simple questions that they should have been asking right from the very start. I mean, it's nice that the New York Times apologized, a few weeks ago for essentially falling for all the lies of the Bush administration. But real journalists would never have fallen for them in the first place. Real journalists would have not taken the statements of people in the administration at face value. They would have investigated them seriously. And I think the performance of the news media in America since September 11th has been absolutely woeful when it comes to what a democracy should be doing. And the New York Times should be more than ashamed of itself. In terms of what it did.
And as a corollary to that, one of the themes Johnson talks about and that you talk about in the film, Hijacking Catastrophe, is the invariable attack on civil liberties.
That's, again, one of the things that happens in an empire. Again, I think it's one of the things that Americans, when I say, the next election is a really watershed mark, is, empires cannot be democratic by their very nature. Military empires cannot have democratic freedoms enshrined within them. Populations that are ruled by fear you can't have democratic institutions side by side with that. And so the attack on civil liberties that has happened since 9/11 is one of the really worrying aspects of what will happen internally to America. That is, when we talk about the American empire doesn't just happen out there. The empire is not just responsible for killing, thousands of Iraqis and for torturing thousands of Iraqis. There is a real effect outside in the world, but there's also a real effect inside as well. One is the kind of constant atmosphere of fear that we operate in, which is mistrust of anyone you don't know, mistrust of strangers, even mistrust of people you know. A scared population, scared people do not make connections with other people. They are scared of other people. And so it fragments the population. It destroys civil liberties. The Patriot Act, the Patriot Act II. Chalmers Johnson, argues that two of the main aspects of the Bill of Rights have essentially been shredded by the Patriot Act, and so it's not even clear that we have all those rights that Americans fought for and it's spilled blood to protect have, in fact, in the last few years have just disappeared.
Yeah, even more striking than the attack on the Bill of Rights, or even more striking if you can put it that way, but as striking, and I think in Johnson's argument, more central has been the abrogation of congressional oversight of military affairs, that basically Congress no longer really is responsible for declaring war, for managing and overseeing the U.S. military. And Johnson argues, I mean, the subtitle of his book is The End of the Republic. I mean, yeah. He argues that, in fact, we are very close, if not at the point where constitutional rule is no longer effective in the United States, and the powerful interests in this country, the military, are beyond the recallability of the population of this country. And in the tenor of your film, and especially in just your comments today, Seth, I get the feeling you see the moment we're at historically is quite different from, say, the 1980s under Reagan or the 1970s under Nixon or the 1920s under Calvin Coolidge, when there was, you know, this concern that governments in power were reactionary and doing awful things. But, you know, the sense that we will muddle through eventually, these guys will be out of power and we'll get on to something else. Chalmers Johnson makes it sound like we're really sort of at a decisive point here that could really take this thing in ways that change the whole history of this nation.
No, I think that's absolutely correct the way you've characterized it. That's why I think it's a watershed mark. This is not just about Tweedledum and Tweedledee anymore, you know, and it's essentially the same, but, you know, they have slightly different ways in which to go about it. There is something very radically, there's something very radical at stake, which is, are we even going to be a democracy? Are we even going to be a republic? And as Chalmers Johnson says, when Congress gave up the right, gave up its constitutional right to have a say in when war is declared, and essentially left it up to one person, left it up to the executive branch. That was what the Constitution was supposed to protect us from. Was supposed to protect us from monarchy. The separation of powers was supposed to make sure that when you went to war, that one person could not declare it. Well, you can now. One person can now declare war and can carry it out. And that one person or that administration can carry it out even when the rest of the world is against it, even when the majority of the American public is against it. It can carry it through. At that point, as Johnson says, I'm not too sure we live in a republic. We are moving towards an imperial mode in which the military have independent power in the society. That's why I think the next election is so fundamental.
We're talking to Seth Jolly today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Seth Jolly is the executive director of the Media Education Foundation based in Northampton, Massachusetts. You can find out about the Media Education Foundation at www.mef.tv. And they are the producers of a brand new documentary, 65 minutes long, called Hijacking Catastrophe. And what's again the subtitle? I don't have it written down here, Seth.
9/11. Fear and the Selling of American Empire.
9/11, Fear and the Selling of American Empire. We only have a few minutes left, Seth Jolly, and I just want to finish up on this really extraordinary documentary that you've just produced that's coming out now. You know, there's a long discussion in there of what are called the chicken hawks. And who are chicken hawks, and why does that have? Why is that relevant to the discussion you're having?
Yeah. Well, chicken hawks, I mean, Chalmers Johnson describes them as, you know, people who have a huge enthusiasm for military adventure and for military action, but without having any experience of military life themselves, of people who, when they had the chance to serve their nation in war, in fact avoided it while supporting that war. So chicken hawks, you have the spine of a chicken, but the spirit of a hawk in the sense that you want to go to war. I think it's a great term, and the term chicken hawk, I think, describes many of these neoconservatives. People like John Ashcroft, people like Paul Wolfowitz.
But do you think if they'd gone to war in Vietnam, like Oliver North, that they would have come back and had different political views?
I don't think they would have had different political views, but at that point they would not have been hypocritical as they are right now, which is, you know, arguing for war in the abstract. And again, I think even with people like Oliver North, in one sense, I have, you know, some respect for him. And at least he knows what war is. And when you make decisions to go to war, you know exactly what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And you may disagree with those, but you can at least you have the basis on. I don't think that experience is everything. I think you can make decisions about these things without having gone to war. I think what is significant about the chicken hawks is the fact that they avoided war when they had the chance. And I think that is, you know, they avoided going to Vietnam. they were quite happy to send other people there. They were quite happy, in fact, to send other African-American, Latino, working-class people there to die for their imperial ambitions while they were sitting in their, you know, nice, while they were getting their educational deferments and sitting in their nice, cozy offices. But at that point, you know, if you don't know, I mean, that's the hypocritical nature of it. If you really believe in war, if you really believed in the Vietnam War, if you really believed in and you supported that, well, you should have gone there. I mean, I have no problem with people who avoided the draft, who in fact were up in opposition to the war. So this is not about only people in war. People who have had experience of war can make decisions about these things. It is about the hypocritical nature of people who regard war only in the abstract. And in fact are willing to send other people to die, but are not in fact willing to put themselves or even their own children at risk. One of the most compelling people we have in the film, in fact I think is, could be one of the most important people between now and the election. Her name is Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski,
mm-hmm.
who worked in the Pentagon when they were constructing the propaganda campaign to convince Americans that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and that he was somehow connected to 9/11. And she saw how this propaganda was put in, how this propaganda operation was put into operation. And one of the things she has a real problem with is people within the military. Again, one of the things we have right now is, you know, the military aspect, the military people in the Pentagon, in fact, are quite hesitant about this war, because they realize how difficult it is, in fact, to fight the kind of war that the Bush administration wants to fight. And what's really pushing the war is the civilian leadership in the Pentagon. People, in fact, who have no experience of war. And so people who have experience of war, in fact, are saying, hold on a second, there's a lot of other issues we need to think about. And those people that don't have any experience of war that are the ones who are gung-ho about it the most. And I think this is very worrying to many people within the Pentagon itself. And Karen Kwiatkowski is one of these people. She's not a left-wing person. She, in fact, said she's been a registered Republican most of her life and is now, in fact, a libertarian. And so her critique of the Bush administration, in fact, you know, is not a progressive critique in the place where I would come from, but it is based on, you know, is based upon the fact that these people are not conservatives. The people in the Bush administration are not conservatives in the traditional sense, and they really are radicals. And in fact, what she calls them chicken hawks, and she actually talks about what she calls a double chicken hawk whammy, which is none of them served, and none of their children served as well. And he says, you know, George Bush talks about how his daughters were the same age as Jessica Lynch, except there was a big difference. You know, Jessica Lynch actually, as a working class woman who didn't have any other opportunities, put on the uniform and did what she needed to do to try and get herself an education. George Bush's daughter didn't go to war. They didn't put on the uniform. And I think that's causing a huge amount of resentment among people within the military themselves.
Well, thank you very much, Sat Jolly, for being our guest today on Media Matters. Sat Jolly is the executive director of the Media Education Foundation based in Northampton, Mass. They produce videos for school use and also for popular consumption. Their website is www.mef.tv. The new film, the new documentary that Sat Jolly and MEF has made, is called Hijacking Catastrophe. Go to that website, learn about it. It will be available this summer. Sat Jolly, again, thank you for being our guest in Media Matters.
It was a pleasure, Bob.
And we'll be back 1 week from today, so join us then. Thank you very much. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Goodbye.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Sugar Creek Symphony and Song, an opera and classical music festival in Watseka, Illinois, August 6th through 8th, featuring Gounod's tragic opera Romeo and Juliet. More information at sugarcreekfestival.org.
A severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for the entire WILL severe weather coverage area until 6 o'clock this evening. That includes Champaign, Ford, Vermilion, Douglas, Edgar, Coles, DeWitt, Piatt, and Moultrie counties. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, showers and thunderstorms likely with heavy rainfall possible. Some thunderstorms may be severe. The high in the mid-80s with south winds around 5 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. A Prairie Home Companion is next. It's 2 p.m.